Okay, good afternoon. Joe Krogan, alcoholic.
And Ken Coleman, I'm an alcoholic.
Thank you all for joining us. This is going to be unique. I'm really honored to do it with Kent. And thank you all for asking me. Thank you, Steve, wherever you are. There he is. Yeah. Steve, he said, I didn't think you'd be here. But thank you for asking us. This is a real honor and privilege. What a great thing you guys have going here, the excitement. I'll push it away. Thank you. Right. The excitement and the spirit of this workshop is incredible. We felt it yesterday when we walked in. Too bad you missed it, Sheldon. No. And we're going to try. This is going to be a little bit different. You know, I hope you're not expecting to hear anything really new. And I'm not here to kind of give you instructions on how to take the step or the steps we talk about this. And I've also heard some people question us about the steps we're doing, 1 and 2, and then 6 and 7, and then step 12. I said, you skipped a couple. We just want to do the God steps. Now, I know you don't think that's what they are, but hopefully that's what they were with me. So before we start, I want to invite that power to be with us today. So let's take a moment of silence if you care to join me. Thank you. Okay, we are, this is going to be a tough thing for me to do and to keep my, I'm going to try not to pretend I know too much. I'm not an expert on Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not a teacher of Alcoholics Anonymous. All I am is a satisfied customer, like Joe said last night. And so I can share a little bit of my experience. I'm going to try and keep my ego out of it, but it's really tough for a guy like me. We were in the gym this morning lifting weights. I'm the kind of guy that when I get off the machine, I move the weight up so it looks like I was doing heavier weight. Even if there's nobody in the gym. Just in case somebody sees me walking out, right? They go, wow, that guy did that? And so you kind of got a glimpse at what my problem is. I used to kind of hide behind that banner of ADD. My wife thinks I'm the poster child for ADD, but I had one of my sponsees clue me in. He said, no, you're just self-absorbed. And that's really my introduction. And steps 1 and 2, I'll tell you, they changed my life. I'd like to tell you and the reason I call them the God steps is because I don't think I could have found a power greater than me unless I absolutely lost the only power that I had in my life, which was me. And in step 1, came to believe that we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. For the longest time, I didn't quite read that step correctly. I put an and in between there instead of a dash. And when I did that, what happened to me was I thought it said, we admitted we're powerless over alcohol, and because of that, my life is unmanageable. And it really didn't say that. And for me, step 1 was about being surrendered instead of surrendering. Because if I surrender, and I did that. I came in here and I thought, okay, I'll try to surrender. But it was an act of self-will for me. And I did try and surrender to step 1. And what happened was I really was waiting to learn how to do it. I'll admit I'm powerless, but I just want you to teach me how to get the power so I can go back and manage my own life again. There's a great story in Language of the Heart. And Bill tells this story about a guy who, his name was Joe, coincidentally. And he says when he met Joe, Joe was a newcomer and he was pretty much on fire for Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's very similar to my story. And Joe said, listen, I'm doing great. And he says, if I can just, I was doing great before I got here, but my wife one day got fed up and threw me out, and I kind of ran my life into the ground. And But I've come to AA, I've turned my life over to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you guys got me sober. If AA can just keep me sober, I'm pretty sure I can make a better go of it now. And if AA just does what it's supposed to do, keep me sober, I can go back out and make my pile, is what he says, and get her back, and I should be able to be okay. And Bill didn't run into this guy for a few years. And when he ran into him again, he says, "Hey, Joe, how'd things going? How'd it work out for you? Did you ever make your pile and get her back?" He said, "No, sadly enough, I didn't." And he said, as a matter of fact, what I discovered was I had to demand a lot less out of life than what I had been demanding. And I'll tell you a little quick qualification, and this is it's real easy for me to qualify. I know in the Alcoholics Anonymous, in our literature, it talks about the two different types, it talks about many types of alcoholics. The one particular type of alcoholic is the one that's normal in every respect except for his drinking. That's not me. I'm the grave mental and emotional disorder guy. So the rest of you will have to wait till Kent talks. But this is addressed to us. And I'm not here to tell you about, I'm not here to tell you you're an alcoholic. I can't, you know, I'm here to tell you I'm one. I want to be here. I need to be here. You know, heck, you guys would, and so do you guys would pay to come here. Oh, you did, didn't you? I mean, this is where we're at on 4th of July weekend. That speaks volumes about you and the people that we're here together with. But here's how I drank. I'll give you a little bit of my drunk log. I didn't quit, I ran out. And I don't stop, I get stopped. There was never a time I said, "That's enough. I think I'll put this away, save it for tomorrow." That's not how I drank. I didn't drink at lunch. I was not one of those guys that would go out and have a cocktail at lunch, because if I drink at lunch, I'm not coming back to work. I'm either drinking or working. I'm not doing both. And I don't drink at dinner. If some people like to have a cocktail with dinner, I don't drink at dinner, because if I'm drinking at if I'm going to be drinking that night, I'm fasting. And we know what that's like, right? I need to be light on my feet. Trouble seems to occur. So I didn't drink for the taste. I never drank for the taste. I never liked the taste. I drank because of the effect. I love the effect. I was totally honest. And you know, alcohol is kind of a two-sided coin. We had that one side where it was a lot of fun. You know, there was a lot of fun in it in those first couple years. It might have been less for you, but in those first couple years, there was a lot of fun. And the magic happened every time. And I tried to recreate that magic and recapture that lightning in a bottle. Tried to recapture that. Those were a lot of fun days. But then all of a sudden, that coin gets flipped. Somehow, it gets turned over. And, you know, that 8 minutes of fun just didn't seem to pay for the 3 days of debacle that would follow. But I was very honest about my drinking in the beginning. When I started off, I said, "This is great, man. Let's go out and get loaded." That was my job, to go out and get loaded. I mean, that was our mission. And at the end, if you asked me, I said, "Tonight I'm only going to have two," when it was absolutely impossible to have two. And I couldn't be honest with me. Somewhere along the line, I started to change, and the honesty, you know, started to deceive myself. I was probably the biggest victim of my own deceptions, and that's when, with step one, is about why all this business of, Bill talks about why all this business about hitting bottom, and all this business about hitting bottom. For me, the definition of hitting bottom is when the reality pierces the delusion, and I can't lie to me anymore. I can't buy my own BS one more day. I heard a friend of mine say, it's when bad things start happening faster than you can lower your standards. And it was getting hard to lower my standards. No. My sobriety date is September 12th, 1990. And I'm still amazed at that. My sponsor was a guy I met 6 months after I got sober, because I attended a six-month treatment center, met my sponsor, and he seemed like he was ancient, this real old guy, and in fact, he was 3 years younger than I am today. So, and sometimes that amazes me. But I drank for the effect. I was the type of alcoholic that used to have a couple drinks to go out drinking. You talked about that last night, Joe. I related to that. I had to get in character because that's the guy I liked. I liked me drinking more than I liked me sober. And my mission was to improve and enjoy my drunk every time I went out. Now, I was a puker for a lot of years, and so, you know, I did some other substances. But I am an alcoholic as described in the big book. I promise you that. But I found that in my experience over the years that alcoholics like drugs. And some of these drugs helped me with throwing up. I stopped throwing up when I did some of these drugs. Now, if you're an old timer here and you've never done any drugs, too bad, it's too late. But I assure you that was only to enjoy and enhance my drinking. Or to get over the hangovers. Which at the end, and I never had a hangover till I was 30. I mean, I was one of those guys who really did drive better, I thought. So on September 12th, 1990, that's my sobriety date. I don't remember a heck of a lot about September 12th, 1990. I remember a heck of a lot about September 11th, 1990. It was a bad day in my life. I'll give you an idea where I was. I'll give you a quick snapshot. And that was where it happened for me. I believe that step one and step two, for me, and I'm not going to tell you, and I could be totally wrong, believe me, 2 years from now I could have a totally different opinion about a lot of things. But step one and step two, I believe I took before I entered the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe that something happened that broke my spirit, that it cried out in anguish. And I believe that when that cry was my cry of step two, I can't do this anymore. And I couldn't, and that's where it happened. The magic, here's where the magic happened. And you would have never told me that this is where the turning point in my life so far was in a Skid Row motel room in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And I was 5 days before my 40th birthday. And I had my 2-year-old son with me. And I had his mom with me, living in that motel room. And we had been there for 6 months. We weren't paying for 6 months, but we were, you know, we're kind of, you can get me in, you can't get me out. I'm a squatter. You get me in there. You got to leave. Okay. Yeah, but I never did. And I was in that motel room, and it talks about it in the doctor's opinion. It says that after we succumb to the drink, as so many do, we enter the well-known stages of a spree. And I was a spree drinker or a binge drinker. Of course, at the end, the sprees were, you know, a few minutes long. I mean, the in-between periods were only a few minutes long. After we enter the well-known stages of a spree, we emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to do it again. And this is repeated over and over again. And I had done that. This is what my last days of drinking looked like. This is when the coin had flipped. And I couldn't stop. And I didn't know I couldn't stop. I was a bitter ender. Now, at 5 days before my 40th birthday, I had run my life to the ground, and I was running everybody's life who touched me to the ground. I had never been to an AA meeting. I did not know anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had never been to a treatment center or never been to a detox. It was number one symptom of insanity is you don't know you have it. I had no clue. I was one of these guys. How could this be beating me? I would wake up in the morning. Remember, some of you might know this. Remember when you would crack your eyelids open after a binge? Anybody remember that feeling? And the first thought that would cross my mind in that motel room was, damn, I'm not dead. Now, I wasn't suicidal. But I did not want to wake up in my life anymore. I was trapped in a life I couldn't get out of. And then you would look around and you would go, and then the panic would set in because it's all gone. The booze is gone, the money's gone, all the opportunity one more time is gone. I did it again. And this would, and the guilt and the shame, and then I would look at my little boy who was in that diaper and in that crib in filthy diapers in that motel room with no, he had a bottle that had once had milk in it, but it it was just basically cloudy water. I would be arrested today if Child Welfare Services had walked in that room and saw me. And I did not intend to be that guy. And I would look at my little boy and I'd cry real tears. See, because I loved my son. And I would cry tears and I'd say, that's it, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. I mean it. I'm going to go out and get a job today. I'm going to put some food in this place. I'm going to turn my life around. And I meant it from the bottom of my heart. And sometimes it would be minutes, sometimes it would be hours, sometimes it would be half a day. It depends on what. And here's how I would start up again. I would start drinking and I didn't know. It was so subtle that I would simply forget that I quit. I would just forget I quit. You know, I would be uncomfortable in that room, in my life, and with the circumstances and what I had done. And I didn't know what the problem was. I had no idea what the problem was. I thought the problem was control. I thought I needed some discipline. As a matter of fact, I thought discipline was my problem. I'd been an undisciplined guy my whole life, and I thought, one of my serious thoughts in that room was, maybe I'll join the Army. Now, they don't take 40-year-old alcoholic crackheads. There isn't a big demand for us out there. But I thought that was my problem, lack of discipline. And I would wake up and seriously want to stop. And I thought armed with a firm desire to stop meant something. It was not until I got here and read the top of page 24 that it says, at the certain point of the drinking of every alcoholic, the strongest desire to stop is of absolutely no avail. Now, I remember when I read that and I asked my sponsor, I said, what's that mean? He goes, wanting to stop drinking has no effect on stopping drinking. And that's what I've been battling my alcoholism with all those years, wanting to stop drinking. I thought, why shouldn't I be able to? I really want to. This is a sincere desire. What is wrong with me? And we all know about step one. We've all heard about it. If there's new people in this room, maybe you can join in with me, because I take a lot of meetings today into detoxes and treatment centers, and I know they say there's not as many 12-step calls. Well, go to a detox. That's a 12-step call. Go there. They're sitting there for you, waiting for you. And I've been privileged enough to go into detoxes for a lot of years, and when I take these meetings into detox, I try and give them the test. Let's do a couple tests. Let's do the tests here today. First test is this. And you know, I don't tell them they're alcoholics, although they're sitting in a detox. My sponsor, I always used to say, Joe talked about, how do we figure out who the new guy is, right? My sponsor, I used to say that to my sponsor. How do you always know who the new guys are? He'd say, well, if you see a guy riding a bike, smoking a cigarette, you know he's not doing it for a workout. So we're not that hard to spot. And so I would ask the guys, I said, and here's the I know it says that in step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, but that means that step one is where we discovered the insanity. That's inferred that we've already know that we're insane. And that was another step I brushed over, because I didn't know I was insane. And you don't, listen, I bet you sound smart to you. Right? I sound smart to me. Thank God I know better today. But that is the number one symptom of insanity, is you don't know you have it. You come up with another brainstorm. You come up with another idea. The good news for me, on September 11th, 1990, I woke up in that motel room and I cracked my eyelids open and I said, damn, I'm not dead. And all of a sudden I looked and it was all gone. The booze was gone. The money was gone. Opportunity was gone one more time. I looked at my son. I started to cry. I said, I'm going to turn this thing around. And I meant it. And then there was a little voice inside my head. And that voice said, no, you don't. You're not going to stop. And this is the first time I ever heard that or thought it. Says, you're not going to stop. You're going to die this way. Whether it be in prison, whether it be in a gutter, you can't stop. And I knew that day I could not buy my lie one more day. And what happened was, that was my beginning. I call it my reverse spiritual awakening. On that day, I discovered what the real problem was. Reality had pierced the delusion. I could see my life through your eyes. I could see that what I had become in that motel room as a deadbeat dad, as a failure in every compartment of my life, at 40 years old, just about 40, and a failure in every area of my life, and didn't know. And I never set out to be this way. I'm not one of these. There might be somebody in here, but I'm not this guy. I'm not the guy that woke up in the morning and said, today I'm going to burn my life to the ground. I never did. Every day I woke up, I said, today I'm going to be as happy and as successful as I possibly can be. Even if it meant just getting a six-pack. And I didn't like beer. But that was success at the end. If I could just score. If I could just get some more booze. Get something in me. And here's what would happen. I would take in that motel room for that 6 months when I would wake up and I'd say, that's it, I'm not going to do this anymore, but I would succumb to the drink. I would take those two beers, I'd guzzle them down real fast, and I'm in this place that nobody should be. And the alcohol worked for me right up until the very end, because here's what I would say after I drank those two beers. Ah, what was I worried about? Things aren't that bad. Tomorrow I'm going to get up real early and go get that job. I swear to God. Tomorrow morning I'll get up early. I'm going to turn my life around. And I did it over and over again until September 11th, 1990. And I realized, you're not going to turn it around. And here's why I wasn't going to turn it around, because here's how I was treating my alcoholism. What does a non-alcoholic do when he has alcohol? A non-alcoholic, when he goofs up with alcohol, goes out, gets a DUI, maybe even gets arrested, maybe loses his job, maybe his wife gets mad at him. He controls it, he adjusts, or he quits, right? And it talks about that, the hard drinker in our book. And see, I had been treating my alcoholism the way a non-alcoholic would treat it for 20-some years. Today I'm not going to drink. Today I'm going to get a job. Today I'm going to pay my bills. I'm going to get food in here. I'm going to be a dad. Well, if I could have done it, I would have done it. And I didn't know that my life was that unmanageable. I had no clue. And on that day, I discovered the real problem. My problem was not alcohol. My problem was not enough alcohol. See, I didn't want to quit. And that may sound strange. I did not come here to get sober. I did not wake up one day. That may be your story. It's not my story. I did not wake up and go, whew, that was close. Time to turn it around. I had been doing that for years. And we say a lot of things in these rooms that I knew over and over again. And you know, we say, you know, you don't ever have to take another drink or drug again if you don't want to. I had not wanted to for a lot of years. I was doing it against my will. So I knew that wasn't going to work. And I didn't know about Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd never even known anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know where you were. I wouldn't have been able to find you if I did. And on that day, I knew what my problem was. My problem was not enough. See, and I think that the newcomer, and I run into a lot of these guys in detox, they're baffled because the truth is, I didn't want to quit. I wanted to just drink with impunity, and I wanted to stay drunk. I want to block out. I want to drink for oblivion, like Bill says at the end, because I could not stand being sober. So my problem was sobriety, untreated sobriety. And on that day, I made a decision. Here's what I'm going to do. And I thought it was a profound decision. I made a decision that I'm going to quit quitting. I'm done. I'm not waking up anymore and feeling guilt or shame. I'm going down with the ship. I can't stop it, however it ends. Now, I didn't realize later on, this is where I think Bill hits bottom in his story. On the bottom of page 7 and page 8, he says, he said, so I was to go on joining the endless procession of sots that had gone on before me. Alcohol was my master. And what that sounds like to me is that he surrendered, or was surrendered, to die of this disease. And on September 11th, I was surrendered to die of this disease. I was in a hopeless position and didn't know, and I was out of ideas. I didn't want to take any ideas. And so here's the test I used to usually give the guys and ask them. I said, listen, let's first describe. And the phenomenon of craving is what our common bond is, the physical addiction. Step one, we admitted we're powerless over alcohol. I believe that has to deal with the physical aspect of alcoholism. We take it. And the phenomenon of craving, I didn't like that when I heard it in meetings, because I always pictured a guy sitting there shaking and saying, I need another drink. And that wasn't me. It was very simple for me. The phenomenon of craving looked like this. I take a drink and I go, I think I'll have another. And that's how it started with me. I think I'll have another. And so the phenomenon of craving, Bill says, is the one common symptom we all have that binds us together. But that in itself would not have kept us sober. We're like shipwrecked people, and the tragedy of our lives would not keep us in this room. It's one element in the cement that does bind us together, but that in itself would not have got me sober. Because how many of us have had moments of clarity? It's real easy to be remorseful in the back of a cop car. Right? Or when she's throwing you out. I'll never do it again, I swear to God. And meant it from the bottom of your heart. And that's the first test. How many of us in this room said to themselves, that's it, I'm done, I quit, I'm not doing this anymore, and meant it from the bottom of their heart? I know I did. Now, that's not the insanity. How many of us drank after we said that? But that's not the insanity. More than once. That's the insanity. That feeling, that terrible desperation to stop and to change my life would evaporate. And I would not be able to stop and change it. Now, I didn't have a God in my life. I did believe in God when I came here. But I was just hedging my bet. Okay, in case there is one, you know, he's probably pissed. I always live like God's not looking. Look, God, Halley's Comet. And I would be off doing... That's really neat. I like how you made that. And I'd be off doing stuff. And that's how I live my life. Like God wasn't watching. So that symptom, that one common symptom, the phenomenon of craving, and even Bill talks about it. He says, why does he behave like this? I love on page 22. It's one of my favorite pages. Why does he behave like this? If hundreds of experiences, more than once, have shown us that one drink leads to another debacle with all its attendant suffering and humiliation. Remember, package deal. It's a whole package deal. By the way, I found out later on that the insanity really is that I cannot connect the drink to the consequence. We cannot bring to mind the certain consequences that come with even taking a glass of beer. They're connected. That's the other thing we say in rooms that it's really kind of misleading for a newcomer. Think the drink through. He hasn't been restored to sanity. That's after step 9. He can't think the drink through. The drink is the only relief we have until we start going through the process of those steps. If I could have thought the drink through, I would have. I did it many times, and it doesn't work. The strange mental blank spot. And he said, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind. So there's my real problem. Is the mental illness that I have in here. And when my ego finally got crushed enough, and that's why I call step 1 a God step for me. When my ego finally got crushed enough, I believe that somehow, and I don't know how exactly it happened, I wish I could tell you, but I think that when you finally hit a bottom like that, or you finally, you know, and we heard it's a God abhors a vacuum. Well, I think I created a vacuum. I had no power. There was no power in my life. And I think that finally I became willing, like so many do. I remember saying the only honest prayer I've ever said in my life, and I didn't say it that day or the next day, but as I ended up in a treatment center, the only honest prayer I'd ever said was, God, if you're there, I'm going to need your help. Because I was out of ideas. I had ideas. I wasn't out of ideas, but they were all bad. And I knew they were all bad. I mean... Right? Joe talked about it. If stuff would have fixed me, stuff would have fixed me already. I'd had the money. I'd had her. I'd had the job. I had a child I loved. I had the best, the deepest love I'd ever felt in my life. Nothing could turn me around. I had no alternative. I had to seek that spiritual solution. And that was a shock for a guy like me. And it talks about it on page 44. If when we drink, we can't control the amount we drink, or when we stop, we can't quit entirely, you may be an alcoholic. And if you're an alcoholic, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Well, that's bad news for a guy like I. Because a spiritual experience, this is what it looks like to me. No sex, no fun, shuffleboard, bingo forever. And maybe pottery classes, no offense. That's what the spiritual experience looks like to me. And if that's what it is, I don't want it. And I had tried it. I can't create it in myself. If I could have, I would have stayed home, read the book, and I wouldn't be here. But I became willing to do something other than my own will. I became willing to listen, and it opened the door. And I believe that, and it talks about it in step one, that we have to stay current with step one. That's the only step we practice 100%. So step one opened me up to the discovery through the process of the other steps, the willingness to go through the other steps, which allowed this power to start to come into this my life. And the last thing I'll say is this. My faith today is a result of the change in my life. It's not the cause of the change in my life. I came here. You made me pretend I had faith and act like I had faith when I didn't. And you made me do things that didn't make sense. Go to meetings. Make coffee. Go pick up Ralph. I'll talk to you about Ralph later. And you may work these steps. Do an inventory. Get on your knees and pray. And you made me do these things that had nothing to do with the IRS who I hadn't paid in 20 years, that I had lost my child, that I had these felonies when I got here. They had nothing to do with any of my real problems. That change is what brought me my faith, not the other way around. Thanks. Ken? Thank you.
Ken Coleman, alcoholic.
Hey, Ken.
Sobriety date is May 18th, 1992. I have a sponsor named Bobby, lives in Nevada. I have a home group. It's the Venice Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Sandusky, Ohio. We are active in our meeting and outside our meeting. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Joe, you know, I love doing this with somebody else, right? Because you get to piggyback. A lot of times I do weekends by myself. Sometimes we do it that way, right? And you listen to yourself talk for 3 days, and it's a little different than when you got somebody with you, right? And Joe says, see, I got to remember that I forget. I got to remember that I forget. We're talking about steps one and two, and we call this the forgotten steps. Right. There's a couple of things I need to remember. That the steps are not an obstacle course. They're not an acute event. They're designed for living. Steps one and two is not something I did 25 years ago and now I'm off into something else. They remain a part of what I do every day. When I talk about the steps in my life, I don't talk about them 25 years ago. I don't live 25 years ago. I'm living now. So where do steps one and two come into play in my life now, today, this day? We got this book. I knew some people who had a hand in this. If you live where I live, you got to know some of them kind of people. And they mailed this book, and they didn't mail a meeting with it. They didn't mail the Music City Roundup with it. They mailed this book. And out of this book came the meetings you attend. Because it told us how to do that, didn't it? How to create the fellowship you crave. Out of this book came the Music City Roundup. Out of this book came the fellowship you crave. Sometimes I go play. I mean, we real blessed today. We got in Sandusky, Ohio, where I live. My home group started in 1938. It was an Oxford group meeting. If you walk out the door in Sandusky, Ohio, and throw a rock, you could hit a building that has an AA meeting in it. And we got meetings morning, noon, and night. There's 2,000 meetings a week in Cleveland. There's another 1,200 in Toledo. They're both within an hour of me. Akron's an hour and 15 minutes away. There's thousands of AA meetings where I live. I want to share some with you. Nowhere in here does it say haven't had a spiritual awakening as a result of attendance. So, see, sometime I need to remember that I can come in here and we've been blessed with so much. We've been blessed with so much that those things become a substitute for what made it all possible. The Music City Roundup, the meetings, all this stuff we get to do are support mechanisms for these steps. They're not a substitute for them. Steps one and two. I want to talk about a little bit how I got here, and then I'm going to talk about them in my life today. I've never been here before when I got here. The first step, I took 3 months sober. And somewhere between 250 and 300 AA meetings attended in them 3 months. 2 months sober without alcohol. 2 months, 60 days. I got a T-bar in my hand at work, and I'm going to smash a guy in the head with it, and I'm going to kill him. That's what I look like 2 months without alcohol and no steps. I picked up a drink when I was 14 years old. I came to you at the age of 32, and in them 18 years, everything that happened to a human being could happen to me, except I died. And I did die. I have flatlined. I have been pronounced dead. I don't sit up here and talk about no good times drinking. Joe talked about the 8 minutes. Ask my mother about them 8 minutes. Ask them how good they were for her. See, I'm not indifferent enough today to glorify this thing that not only nearly destroyed my life, but took the people who love me, the significant relationships in my life, to a place where they never should have had to go. I don't sit up here and do that. You hear me talk, and some of you have. I don't sit up here and talk about, listen, I had good parents. I came from a privileged home. I went to a million concerts. I did all that stuff. Whoopee, whoopee, yay, yay. I was 16 years old with a driver's license that said I was 22. I'm in places a young man has no business, and my parents know it. I brought sleepless nights, resentment, fear, guilt, shame into my mother and father's home, infected them with it till they were sicker than I was. And I want to sit around and talk about the good times I had drinking. See, I live in the real world today. There was nothing redeeming about this. Nothing. And I'm glad you had fun. All I did was escape the reality of my own life. And that's no way for me to live. If I had the power to quit drinking on my own, I'd have never come here. Why should I? Joe talked about it. I died. And they put the paddles on me, and I'm in the cardiac unit, and there is absolute chaos in the cardiac unit at Providence Hospital in Sandusky, Ohio. My family, my girlfriend's family, the Catholic priest, Pastor Brown, just chaos up there. I ain't a tornado. I'm a full-blown hurricane, Jack. And I lay there with tears running down the side of my face with all these wires stuck on me. And I said, God, if you let me live, I swear I'll never do it again. And I was laying in that bed in the cardiac unit as a direct result of the use of alcohol and some of its cousins. And I want you to know something. When I said it, I meant it as much as I mean it today. I wasn't joking. I spent 2 days in the cardiac unit. They took me out. They put me in a regular room, said my heartbeat was stable. A medical miracle is what the doctor called it. 2 hours later, I'm chugging two tall boys of Swiss Malt Liquor Bull and doing the very same thing that got me in there. You know what I thought after I got out of the cardiac unit? Here's the thought that came to me. Joe said it a while ago, but in a different context. Whew, that was close. But I'm all right now. This calls for a celebration. Is anybody in here? No, that, dude, I got to remember. Joe talked about obsession. I want to talk about the power of obsession. Sometimes I don't think we talk about that. Because when that thought came to me, there was no debate. There was not a voice that said, wait a minute, 48 hours ago, you said, God, if you let me live. No! Is anybody like me? That ain't in the room. I got sentenced to 5 years in the penitentiary. They told me, before we throw you away, they put me on a period of indefinite probation, which I was going to protest, but I have a lawyer that's going, shut up, shut up, shut up. And she told me a dirty urine, and you're going to do every one of these 5 years. And she said, I ain't shocking you out. Last chance. My uncle was the mayor of Sandusky, my mother's older brother. My mother and father were well, that's the kind of family I come from. I walked out of the courtroom and said, God, I just got the break of my life. I'll never drink again. And I meant it as much as I mean it now. I didn't want to go to prison no more then than I do now. A couple days later, I got to go report to adult probation. It's Friday morning. I get off work. I got an hour to kill before they unlock the door at the courthouse. As I'm driving across town, here's the thought that comes to me. You know, they say they never test you on your first time reporting. They don't think anybody's that stupid. Who is they? There was no debate here. Wait a minute, Kent. If you drink and they catch you, you're going to Mansfield. This was where they shot the movie Shawshank Redemption, biggest steel prison in the world. That's where I got sentenced to. Most people who go there don't come out. A lot of them. Right? That's where I'm at. There's no debate. I roll into the Super Bowl tavern, finger goes up, 8 ounce water glass of old granddad, because that's what I drank, and I stagger into adult probation with 5 years in the joint hanging over my head. And I didn't do that because I'd rather be drunk than sober. I didn't do that because I'd rather be in prison than be free. I understand the concept of powerlessness. If I had the power to stop that, I'd have stopped it. Put a drink in me. And my body screams for more. I had that when I was 14 or 15 years old. I always drank differently than other people, but I thought it was because I drink like a man and y'all drink like little girls. Right? Everybody wants to go play basketball. Go play basketball for what? We got liquor. My cousin used to have parties on Saturday night. On Sunday, she would let us come and clean up what was down in the basement. And these guys would have a couple of drinks, my cousins, and they want to go, let's go ride, let's go down to the park. Go ride down to the park or what? You walk down to the park, I'm driving, I ain't leaving here till this liquor is gone. I was like that when I was 15, 16 years old. I just attributed it to greater capacity than you. I didn't understand that physically something happens when I put booze in me that don't happen to you. Spiritual malady, soul sickness. I'm a guy at the age of 14. Ooh, I love Dr. Bob's nightmare. Dr. Bob said, when I got old enough, I ain't coming to church no more. Right? See, my life prior to Alcoholics Anonymous, my life prior to picking up a drink, my life was always based on what I think you think of me. I'm a guy who feels less than. I'm shy. I'm insecure. I'm afraid. And I found out when I was 14 that when I pour booze on that, it produces in me what Joe talked about, a sense of ease, comfort, well-being, fearlessness. Dude, I change and so do you. That's the effect produced by alcohol. And that happened to me when I was a kid. Alcohol's an answer for me. It ain't a problem. You the problem. And I was to believe that for many, many years. Doctor's opinion, Bill's story, there is a solution, more about alcoholism. Your step one information. More information on that one, because you don't get that one, and the rest of them may happen. I love how Wilson said it in 12 and 12. Why all this insistence, right, on this surrender deal? Because if you drink and you ain't, who going to write an inventory drunk? Who want to go out and make amends drunk? I wrote some inventories drunk, and they was all about how the world was treating me. I actually did that. I would sit up at night with my life falling apart, and I would write these long letters to a guy about the tragedy of my life. And it was the guy who later would be the man who put me in treatment. And I would be like, man, you just don't understand what's happening to me. And I would pass out, and I would wake up in the morning, and I would read them letters. I'd be horrified that another human being might read them. I'd rip them up and flush them down the toilet. May 16th, 1992, I'm sitting in a car in the parking lot of Daly's Pub, the Pump Lounge outside of Sandusky on Route 4. This is the thought that came to me. The thought that came to me was not, I need to stop drinking. I had stopped trying to stop drinking. I went to church, read the Bible, read self-help books, did everything that you know what the stuff we do. And I couldn't shut it off. I had a Bible in this hand and a Miller High Life in this hand. Right? I gave up that deal. The thought that occurred to me on May 16, 1992, sitting in the parking lot of the Pump Lounge, was this. There has to be more to life than this. There has to be. This can't be it. At that point in my life, I don't take baths, I don't take showers, I go to work 2 or 3 days a week. I got a liver that's distended about 7 inches. I live like an animal. I'm not allowed in my parents' home. Y'all know the story. I'm a stumble bum, low bottom guy. There's a guy named Six-Pack Charlie in Cleveland. He said, that's the moment when God paralyzes the liar in you long enough for you to see the truth. So I end up I make a phone call, I end up in treatment. And where I went to treatment at a place called Green Hall in Xenia, Ohio. It's one of them hospital treatment centers that used to flourish in the 80s and early 90s. I got a $35,000 big book at that joint. And I'll tell you this, it's worth a million. It's worth a million. I'm glad I had my insurance had the 35 grand to pay them. Right. And they spent the whole time I was there on step one. Back in the day, a lot of treatment centers used to have you do a fifth step before you leave, right? They think that they need to grind. Man, they didn't even go there with me. It was step one for 35 days. And it was a 28-day program. 28 days, but they cut my insurance off because they used to pay for 28 days. And I worked for Ford Motor Company. And the treatment center called the Ford plant where I worked and said, we don't think Kent's ready to leave the hospital. You know what they set up the Ford plant? We don't either. And they actually physically wrote a check for me to stay there another, it was like $7,000 for me to stay there another week. Step one. When I got home, I started to go to meetings. I had to move back into my mom and dad's house from which I had been banned. I talked about this the other day. Before I went to treatment, my mother had to take me to JCPenney's and buy me clothes because I didn't have any. Now, I worked at Ford Motor Company and did not have a car. This is difficult, but a guy like me can pull this off. Last car I had, they cut me out of at the corner of Columbus Avenue and Taylor Street on a Sunday morning with the roof of the car smashed to the level of the door. And there was a cop, his name was Chico, he was a friend of the family, and when they got me out of that car, he looked at me and he said, you were supposed to die today. They towed that car 2 blocks away from my mother and father's house to a Sunoco station owned by a guy named Bill, and my father went up there with me to look at that car. My father looked at that car and he looked at Bill and he said, get that thing out of here before his mother sees it and it kills her. But I'm having a good time, Jack. I ain't hurting nobody. So I ain't got no car. Right. And my mother took me to buy me clothes. And we were standing in line at JCPenney's, and my mom looked at me, and I saw something in my mother's face that I had not seen since I was a kid. I saw hope in my mother's face. A lot of times I wanted to walk out of treatment. It was people in treatment drinking. They found a way to sneak out the hospital and go get booze. And if you think I didn't want to drink you, out your mind. And when they told me, Kent, we're going to sneak out and go to carry out and get something to drink, can we bring you something back? And I saw my mother's face. And I ain't had no defense at that point. I ain't going to sit up here and lie to you. I wanted it bad. And I said, no, not today. Not today. And I got out of there and I started going to meetings. You know, like my mom and dad let me in the house, but they wasn't happy I was there, and they shouldn't have been. My father told me, he said, one slip up, dude, and you out of here. The only place that I could go, I couldn't go back where I used to go, was AA meetings. I've always loved AA meetings. Didn't understand them. Didn't really like y'all personally. But I always felt better after an AA meeting. Anybody ever? Always felt better after an AA meeting. I finally got me a little piece of car, and I used to give an old timer a ride to a meeting. His name was Walter Wilfong. Walter Wilfong got sober in 1948, I think. And I was giving, nobody liked Walter. He screamed a lot. but he was kind of crazy, and so was I. So I liked Walter, you know. And I said, Walter, I said, you know what, man, no matter what I got going on, like, and I didn't have no sponsor, nothing. I said, no matter what I got going on, I always seem to feel better after the meetings. And Walter looked at me and he said, don't you know why that is, dummy? And I said, no, why is that, Walter? And he said, what's the first thing that we do at a meeting? I said, we say the Serenity Prayer. He said, what's the last thing that we do at a meeting? I said, we say the Lord's Prayer. And he said, and where two or three are gathered together, God is in our midst. And he said, son, that's why you always feel better after an AA meeting. You've been sitting in the presence of the Spirit. And I learned that because I gave an old-timer a ride to a meeting. We talk a lot about giving newcomers a ride to a meeting, give old-timer a ride to a meeting that can't drive at night anymore, who can't drive, who we've now discarded because we ain't got no use for them. Give an old-timer a ride to a meeting, you might learn something. So I'm going to meetings like crazy. I told you 60 days in this thing, I'm going to bust a dude up in his head. If a guy hadn't came up behind me and saw what I was getting ready to do and grabbed that thing out of my hand. And incidentally, I sponsored that guy today who grabbed it out of my hand. And you know what the guy told me? He said, man, you better go get a drink because you're going to kill somebody. That's me 2 months sober. No steps, nothing. And I'm going to 3 meetings a day, 4, 5, 6 on the weekends because I got nowhere else to go. Three months sober. I'm in the parking lot of Daly's Pub, downtown Sandusky, and I'm going to drink. And I don't want to. I don't know what's outside that green door at Daly's Pub, but I do know what's in there. And I know if I go in there, be it literally or figuratively, I ain't coming out. And I know it. I said my first prayer.
I've been in AA 3 months. I ain't said a prayer except the Serenity Prayer and the Lord's Prayer at the meetings. I ain't said a prayer. I ain't done nothing. And I said, God, what am I doing wrong? What am I, some kind of freak? I go to 3 or 4 of these meetings every day and I'm going to drink. God answers prayer. And I got it immediately. What are you doing right? If you go to that many meetings, you hear it every day, don't you? You know, I used to go around and say, I went to all them meetings and I didn't learn nothing. That is a lie. Because when I said that prayer and I got the answer, what are you doing right? You're not doing nothing, these people. If you go to that many meetings, you hear it every day. Get a sponsor, read the book, work the steps, get a home group, get a commitment, help others, right? I do none of that. Because I went to all those meetings, I knew. I knew where to go and I knew who to go to. And that's because I went there. There ain't never a wrong reason to go to an AA meeting. Ever. And I went to a man in Lorain, Ohio. I turned the key in that car. I drove 25 miles in Lorain, Ohio. I walked into a gymnasium where there were 600 people every Thursday night. And I walked up to the man who started that meeting, and he was sitting in the back, and his name was Bill F. And I walked up to Bill, and I said, will you help me? And Bill got sober in 1958, and Kenny was there. Kenny from Cleveland, and I love Kenny. Kenny was sitting next to Bill. Kenny came in 72. Kenny's sponsor was Ted R. in Cleveland. Ted was sponsored by Dr. Bob. I knew these guys. And Bill looked at Kenny, and Kenny looked at Bill. And Bill said, what do you think? And Kenny said, well, he's closer to you than me, so you take the bad half, and I'll take what's left. And those are the two men who raised me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill died 52 years sober. Kenny is now 45 years sober. Sheldon met him in Akron. He was on the old-timers panel at Founders Day. Kenny sponsored everybody on the west side of Cleveland with over 25 years. He's an amazing human being. And he got new guys around him all the time. And new guys raised me in AA. And they got me into these steps. They started taking me through the book, and it scared me half to death. I thought whoever wrote this had been following me around. Did Jay Walker? Oh, you got to love Fred and Jim, right? Just got out of the nut house, right? As I crossed the threshold, of the lobby, the thought occurred to me it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails and go back to the nut house. Really? Really? I'm going to put whiskey in the milk. Ah, that's my cat, right? The Jay Walker, right? Continual promises. I'm going to cut this out. Then it goes, on through the years, this conduct continues. Right? Man, because I'm a simple guy, man. Is that me? Oh, my God. Yeah, that's me. Over and over and over. Bill's story. Kent's story. Man, what did Bill try to use to stay sober? Self-knowledge, willpower. He tried fear of consequences he might face. They made me go back and look at my life. That's me. I fully conceded to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic. And now I know what an alcoholic is. It's not Otis on the Andy Griffith Show. Understand the disease of mind, body, and spirit from which I suffer and you suffer. And I'm sitting up in here with y'all. Right? And then I get this home group. I joined the Venice group. 4 guys in there got sober between 44 and 46. All right. And they helped me. They used to take me places with them. They used to gather together on Sunday and do Oxford group stuff. Step 6 and 7, which we're going to get into. They would journal and share their experiences from the week. I'm sitting with people who were sober 15 years before I was born, and they talking about what they learned this week.
The youngest sobriety at that Sunday meeting was a woman with 38 years. I had 18 months. We talked about this last night, and I asked John, how come y'all asked me to be here? I don't belong in here. And he said, yeah, you do, and that's why we asked you. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable. Right? Now, we got to the chapter, We Agnostics. And I said to my sponsor, we can skip that one. He said, Bill said, why? I said, because I ain't agnostic, I'm Baptist. He looked at me and he said, oh, I disagree. He said, you, sir, are a functioning agnostic. I was insulted. I said, what is that? He said, that is a person who professes to believe in God, but who lives like there isn't one. A person who professes to believe in God, but who lives like there isn't one. Right between the eyes. I want to talk about something that's current. See, back then, like, I looked at my mother. There was people in my family that had great faith. And they lived wonderful lives. And they lit up rooms and they helped people. My mother been dead since 1994. And there ain't a week to go by in Sandusky, Ohio when somebody don't talk to me about my mama. My mother was the president of the Ohio Baptist Women's Convention and the highest ranking woman in Christ the Corporation in the 1960s and 1970s. My mother was a power. And my mother lit rooms up. And I would be in trouble, and I would desperately want to stop living the way I was living, and I would do the only thing that I knew to do at that time in my life, and that was go where she went, and she went to church. And I would sit in the back, and I would be like, when they had an altar call, I'm going to go down here, and they're going to pray for me, and it's going to change my life. It's going to change, and I'm going to be like her, and I'm not going to have to live like this anymore. And they'd have that altar call, and I'd go down there, and they would pray for me, and as I'm walking back to my seat, I haven't changed. And I came to believe that either I'm too bad or I'm unworthy of God's help. So when I came to you, my belief was I'm not good enough. You ever hear anybody? I used to hear them say it all the time. When I stop some of this drinking and gambling and running the streets, I'm gonna go back to church and get right with God. I'm gonna get good, and then I'm gonna go get with God. If I could get good on my own, I wouldn't need God. I need God to change my life. I don't get none of it. So step two for me, I'm like, I tried that, man. So the question begs, right? Today, right? Because I really came to believe, step two, because of you. See, because in step one, right, through identification, I joined the club. So in step two, came to believe a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Now, I done joined the we in step one. Now, I believe that it can happen for you, but can it happen for me? If I got what you got, then yes, it can. So is there a power greater than myself, right? And do I believe it can restore me to sanity? Two things I got to look at here. I did believe there was a power greater than myself, like Joe. I believed the guy was a guy. Right? But do I believe it can restore me to sanity? The only thing that helped me with that was you. I heard people tell stories Stephen King couldn't make up. Right? You already know when we get together, you can't make up the stuff we do. But what I saw were people who were sober many years, who were smiling, who exuded the attraction that we talk about here. Today, What keeps me current with one and two? Joe alluded to something earlier. The restoration to sanity is in step 10. It says, for by this time, sanity will have returned. See, I need to remember that I forget. I need to remember that I forget. So how do I remember today? How do steps one and step two stay fresh in my life? The remaining steps. You know, our book says, I sponsor sponsors in AA. I don't have a bunch of sponsees, like I'm not herding sick guys behind me like cattle. Come, sponsees. My responsibility is to get these steps active in your life so you can carry the message to somebody else, because this book says that'll work when all other measures fail. That is my responsibility when you ask me to help you, is to get you there. And if I don't, then I've failed you. So in working with others, I am continually, right, living, right? It's an unbelievable dynamic. Right, I see powerlessness every day, and it keeps that fresh in me. I see it every day. Right? Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. How many times today am I living in functional agnosticism? I want to share some with y'all. When confronted with a problem or an issue, to this day, 25 years later, my first thought is this. Is there anybody here like me? What do I need to do? Is anybody here like me? What do I need to do? Right? To this day. Right? The beauty of what we have here is that I've been doing this long enough now. Right, that I don't stay there. I used to stay there for like weeks, right? And then I would take one of them beatings sober, right? And finally, oh my God, if I surrender, I might get some help here, right? Maybe I should actually tell my sponsor this is going on, right? What's happened is I let go a little quicker now. I'm making some progress in here. So when I look at steps one and two in my life, I'm not deluding myself that that's all back here now. How many times have we seen somebody 30, 35, 38 years up in here pick up a drink? My sponsor used to make me go to Rosary Hall in Cleveland where Sister Ignatia used to be every time an old timer in Cleveland got drunk. He said, I want you to go see him. I said, I don't even know him. He said, I didn't ask you that. Go do what I told you. And I'm feeding some old-timer Jell-O who's shaking so bad that he can't hold a spoon, and he's telling me what happened. Right? Started giving this back a step at a time. Steps one and two, as they were and are in my life. Every morning, I do a thing where I go through the steps in meditation, each one. Right. And then I get up off of my knees and I put some feet on the things that you've taught me as best I can. I don't do it perfectly. I don't know anybody who does. There's days if you follow me around, you never know I've been in one of these meetings. Right. But those days just seem to get a little further apart. And that's steps one and two. And I want to thank you for having us here. I want to thank my friend Joe. God bless. Thank you.
Good job, man.